Okay, so with that, since the speakers are all pretty good about sticking to the time limits, we have almost a full hour for discussion. I'm sure there's lots of questions. So we're just going to start with a couple, and depending on how difficult they are, we'll do one at a time, or we'll collect a couple. I have a feeling like there may be some.
So first I have a question for Alberto. What you're saying about the immediatism of the ultra-left sounds very similar to some of the trends that have been developed by Ishvan Mesal. So I'm just wondering what your attitude towards some of his recent work and publications is generally. My comments will be addressed more, I think, to Peter. You're ending on a very promising, to my mind, note that is very congruent with the direction that my thought has been going fairly recently, particularly on the need for a party, but also struggle within the party. And something that I didn't hear you say, but I think is necessary for such struggles to be open before the class, that the relationship between the party and the class is such that one is not outside the other, exterior to the other, but that there is a continual dialectical interaction between the two, and that that, that necessitates, therefore, that the struggles that take place have to be open in the same way. Speaking of it biographically, until recently, I was a supporter of a small organization called the League for the Revolutionary Party, which, in its basic approach, takes towards the question of class consciousness, takes a very similar approach to that of Lukács in that final essay, History and Class Consciousness, namely that the party is the instantiation of the highest levels of consciousness within the class that enables the class to become conscious and for itself. Ultimately, any question of organizational structure, I think, has to be a political question of how does the proletariat fit itself for power and prepare for the overthrow of capital. That requires unification of theory and practice with a continual eye towards the validation and extension of both of those. And that's why what I really want to stress is in the development of theory, the need for a scientific approach, namely the elaboration of a research program complete with practical tests which revolutionary militants, as the subjects who are elaborating that understanding of capital, are also challenging themselves to put into practice and put to the test in entire political struggles. The question ultimately is, what is to be done? And if I had that answer, I would have written an essay. But I think for those of us who continue to take Lenin as a necessary reference point, we need to acknowledge the fact that, among other things, what is to be done was talking about how to make effective use of a newspaper, and that 100 years later, we need to recognize the different modes of social organization and interchange that are taking place within the very working class movement that we have to be a part of.
Okay, so maybe just respond to that quickly. Oh,
yeah, I just plead culpable ignorance, so I'll take up your suggestion. Look up here.
Very, very briefly, I think the question of the party being open before the class needs to be developed a little bit further in considering the stratification of the class itself, because of course the class as such is a little bit like the economy in Althusser's construction. It's this thing that sort of never really arrives. We never come face to face or encounter the class as such. We come into contact with stratified elements and dimensions and dynamics of the class, and sometimes that will occur at the political level in different institutions and forms. In other times, it'll occur in what are equally institutions but often not recognized as such, as various practices and conventions and so forth. So it's not simply a question of a sort of transparency between the party and the class, but the element of the stratification of the class being as in some ways valorized by the organizing instance of the party. So that relationship also needs to be thought as a continual dialectical exchange, not simply between two prior composed subjects, if we want, a party and class, but as constitutively divided and conflictual elements which contain levels of, if we want, certain uneven dimensions, certain areas of temporal delay or advance. So to think through those concretely as they occur between organizing instances and the various levels of association and how they come into contact and are able to increase the capacity to act of each. In terms of then thinking through the proletariat being fit for power, what I think is interesting in Gramsci's proposal is that he configures the modern prince, and he's conducted a lot of researches in prison. When he gets to thinking through the modern prince, that we have some brief suggestive remarks that he makes which don't seem to be fully cashed out. And I think that in some ways misunderstands many of the other notes that he's written in the prison notebooks, which is precisely the attempt to think through the various elements in what Gramsci will refer to as the subaltern classes in the broadest sense are able to develop their own practices and institutions which would be linked to the interests of themselves conceived as a class. So we're not discussing here, if you want, some type of moment of will here as a subjective decision, an instance where simply a group of people make a decision to unify themselves, but as one that occurs in the concrete terrain of contradictory capitalist relations of production. And in terms of making those groupings of people and the relations between them fit for power, I think in the notion of the modern prince, Gramsci wants to think about the expansive institutional form, which will not, as it were, be a type of new state within a state or a provisional government, but certainly will embody some of the type of institutional practices and procedures that Gramsci thinks are necessary for any type of what he calls a self-regulated society. So that constitutes processes of developing institutions of conflict which are productive and creative for the development and the furthering of those interests and which don't turn then into various forms of bureaucratic degeneration. As said, Gramsci's notion of the modern prince has been referred to in the past and often mistaken as simply referring to forms of political organizing we already knew. I think Gramsci was trying to take that further, and it's about beginning that research project again and thinking through those dimensions where I think there's really a lot of very fascinating work to be done on his prison notebooks today.
Okay. I see a couple of hands of people that are... Okay, only one? Okay.
I have a question for Peter Alberto. To maybe bring you into dialogue a little bit. In terms of that, the idea of this Aristotelian collection of constitutions rather than a platonic idea, in your case, for your critique, Alberto, of the kind of illusory abolition of capital scalar problem of thinking the transformation of social relations not being just like, oh, we're changing our relationship to our friends, that kind of small scale, but this actual real scale of the social relationship capitalism. And I was hoping, so the first part is kind of a historical question, which is maybe related to Aaron and Maya's critique of programmatism and the fact that workers weren't really socialized as a kind of class conscious subject on the factory floors. More of these kind of shooting clubs, sporting societies, in the place of the reproductive sphere, and kind of Marx and Engels talked about the bar culture of Paris being kind of part of work, smoking tobacco and drinking together. And I'm wondering if this relates back to the problem of the kind of question of what is to be done today, but really that question has to be posed at such a scale that's much bigger than all of these previous proto-class-conscious revolutionary subject institutions, or institutions in formation that existed in the past. There's no site, in a way, for the experience collectively of capital contradictions lead to a kind of formation of a revolutionary subject to be more Foucauldian problematic than you guys have. But, so this is the problem of like 7 billion humans, and how does the collective experience of capital's contradiction of 70 billion humans and its various fragmentations, even on the individual level, where in this kind of late capital moment, we've compartmentalized experience to such an extent that the contradiction at work is different than the contradiction at home when you're taking the kids to school, different than the contradiction when you're relating with your wife, that kind of what's described by Jameson as the schizophrenia of experience, but more neutrally or shattering of the experience of contradiction in all these compartments. So how does that coalesce? Is the problem both on this scale of the individual and then on the scale of 7 billion humans on the planet? Maybe that's why we can't think of what is to be done.
And I think the scalar and the scalar problem you're talking about is obviously significant, but there's, I think, in a lot of these recent discussions, and indeed, since you mentioned Jameson, I think it's very evident in his work as well, there is this kind of antinomy or sort of oscillation between, on the one hand, a notion of, in fact, far greater homogeneity. I mean, this lies behind, I think, very much some of the theses that you find in Hart and Negri. I mean, that's, you know, the sort of horizon is, in a sense, or, you know, the fact that there's been this use often, I think, you know, rather impressionistic of the of and literal, let's say, of the idea of real subsumption, I think nevertheless, for all the problems I may have with it, does register some sense of a sort of homogenization, you know, or for instance, you know, an increase in the, you know, relative or absolute increase in the amount of wage laborers at the level of daily, you know, an experience of you know, commodified contemporary culture, which is much, you know, one might say much more global, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, at the same time as, of course, the same authors, and Jameson being a case in point, have identified this fragmentation, decomposition, compartmentalization of experience as well. So I think that is a problem. The problem I thought was interestingly posed in Aaron and Maya's talk was whether, you know, what is it to think about class politics and class consciousness if one doesn't have, well, if we can't talk about class culture, let's say, in a very broad sense, in a way that seemed normal when there was, you know, when this, you know, synonymy between, you know, industrial working class or certain types of working class and working class in general was posed. But I think that problem remains, and one of the issues that I have with some of the theoretical tendencies recently is an excessive tendency to, this is actually very common from everything from, you know, Agamben and Invisible Community, et cetera, to just engage in this complete disjunction between some politically purified notion of the proletariat and then, you know, the working class is something you relate to a workers' movement, which you just declare dead by fiat. And that I find very, you know, very unconvincing. And but at the same time, as I think the point that you raised about, I do think that a lot of the, you know, I do think that struggles at the level, I mean, certainly if you take the current, you know, situation that Peter was talking about, you know, the difficulty is how do you, you know, how do you identify in varying kind of unequivocally class and antagonistic terms what are struggles not at the point of production, or not straightforwardly so. And I think that is very significant, and I do think that should affect the forms of organization that are at work. So for instance, I mean, it's very embryonic, but I do think, you know, the fact that you have people trying to organize in Britain kind of anti-cuts committees at a council, you know, at the level of like the city councils, in the ultra-left sense, just at the level of, you know, city councils, so is quite interesting. You know, the fact that, you know, if you're picketing at a university, you'll get, you know, quite explicit solidarity, including people joining your pickets if they're working locally and so on. I think that is a significant resource that would need, you know, be among the politically accumulatable elements, I think, that Peter was talking about. And just as a minor point, I think, just to be, you know, fair to the arguments made by both, you know, the Endnotes group and the Teilhard Communist thing, actually, they're very explicit about the fact that their understanding of communization is not as Anclet theory, it's not as lifestyle. And this is also why it's very, you know, why it's quite stark, because the whole point is that unless there is this kind of generalization, then it just counts as one way in which people sort of make do, and in fact not just make do, but allow capital to reproduce itself, because it's sort of outsourced your own reproduction outside, you know, outside of the state or outside of immediate, you know, wage relations and so on. So I mean, you know, dumpster diving, not, you know, not prefigurative, as it were.
A few things. I suppose one, historically, the working classes in the broader sense have always been constituted and composed not simply on the factory floor or in the workplace, but in broader social spaces, in communities, and so forth, and that's historically was a decisive element. I'd suggest that equally today that that needs to be included in the analysis. So for a lot of the discussions, obviously, about the death of the working class, et cetera, the immense expansion of the working class in simple objective terms as those who are forced to sell their labor power in order to guarantee the reproduction of their lives, it has been immense and increasingly so over the last 30 years. So, of course, those types of struggles occur inside workplaces and outside workplaces and always decisively linked. Gramsci's notion of the subaltern classes in the broader sense can get you somewhere in some direction thinking through these dimensions. Equally, then, the question, of course, is always the one of precisely where it's possible to strike capital and the necessity of insisting upon the class struggle in production, not because of any moral superiority of that point to other instances of struggle, because it's precisely there. Like, if we want the thesis of immediate communization, it's precisely in production, at the wage contract, at that level, where there needs to be decisive struggle in order to break capitalist power. But of course, historically, as we've seen, all of that is condensed into various forms and is mediated to the level of state power. This is why I think the elements of certain, if we want certain forms of economism that occurs inside some contemporary discussions coming out of value form theory, can really be quite dangerous. Politics is about the state. You know, Matteo was discussing this quite decisively. You have to fight on that level, because even when that terrain is abandoned, the bourgeoisie does not. It keeps possession of the state apparatus and will consistently use it in all sorts of contexts for instances of state repression. The question always remains one of dialectics. You have to be able to think these instances together against each other and constantly oscillating between those elements, I think, to have any capacity to compose some type of political force. One further element in terms of then questions of class consciousness, I mean, there is a big insistence in a lot of recent discussions around notions of the political subject, elements of political subjectivity. There's a certain absence of political subjectivity which somehow we have to inspire in order to then motivate different forms of actions. I'm very skeptical of that approach as the most useful one of confronting current political struggles. I think people are quite aware in all sorts of areas about different problems that are going on in their lives and things they don't particularly like. It's not a problem of consciousness or subjectivity. It's a problem of an absence of organizational forms that make it possible for people to meaningfully engage in those forms of political action in terms of building that into the process of living their own lives. There's, as it were, a restriction of access to areas of political activity because of the lack of these institutions. So rather than us waiting for different political moments that would be ushered in by the arrival of the political subject on a white horse and so forth, it would seem to me more useful to think about precisely what sort of institutions would open spaces for that political engagement to become more possible for larger groups of people who are already at different levels and forms engaged in forms of everyday resistance all the way through to nascent forms of organized forms of resistance.
Do you also want to respond to touch on?
Saying, how do we pull these individual activists together who are involved in activity within, that's effectively activity that's not challenging the state, that's all the kind of stuff that Alberto was talking about now, that is the day-to-day grind of the real struggles within capitalism, as it happened in Russia in 100 years ago, and turn them into a national organisation. And essentially, then we've got a very similar situation here. And what the three speakers are talking about at different levels of abstraction is that situation where we're talking about we've got real leadership of real movements at a ground floor. I think the question of strategy is relatively straightforward. The problem's alienation. We've lost control of the beast. We need democratic control over it. And you then have a basis for criticising particular acts of direct action on the basis of, do these allow us to foster more democratic control, or do they not? Is this just another elite acting in a particular way, or is it, does it allow us to build majorities of socialists in a particular area? It's not for or against any of those particular acts, but it is a concrete analysis at each juncture whether that particular kind of act works. And I think the strength of Matteo's paper was saying that politics is about the state. The weakness is then that those people involved in the day-to-day activity are not political. Because if we deny that they are political, then we ignore the necessity of actually pulling them together as an organised group is a political act. And that's the key thing, the key strength of the Leninist position. So it's effectively, I'm agreeing with the three people, but trying to bring it to a more concrete register to move from the abstract to the concrete. The weakness, you know, the final movement that Peter was making from Lukács to Gramsci, is that movement to a more concrete. Then what we're talking about actually is real individuals involved in real leadership of the social movements at the moment are Ayn's 57 varieties of groups, schools, and individuals and whatever else. How can we pull them together? That's the fundamental issue of the day, the question of the modern prince. How can those people be pulled together? One barrier amongst many is the bogeyman of Lenin that exists within these milieus.
Alex, does yours connect?
Actually, it was connected with what Paul just said.
Well, then why don't you go ahead and then we'll have a panel response.
Well, I wanted to say that I agree with the conclusions of all three speakers, but I didn't agree with I agree in general with what you said, Paul. But there was one thing that I didn't really agree with you, and I think it's a really important issue. You said that the strategy is relatively easy. I don't think that's true at all. Because I think what strategy is about, and this is part of the greatness of Lenin, is being able to hold on to the thread of proletarian self-emancipation through all sorts of variations in the situation that you're operating in. Sometimes you have some sense of becoming not insurrection but variation. Sometimes it takes you by surprise. Sometimes the really important issue becomes one that has no apparent direct relationship with the class struggle, but turns out to be really important. So in Cairo, I think it was yesterday, 10 people were killed when Islamic Salafists, extreme Islamists attacked Christians around because they claim a Muslim woman has been kidnapped and is being forced to convert to Christianity. Now that's, you know, it's got no apparent relationship to the class struggle, but it's an immensely dangerous development for the revolution in Egypt, because it conjures up the possibility of people beginning to be divided along sectarian lines. So today, a communist in Egypt would have to be thinking about how to address that question, how to build forms of unity that can undermine those kinds of sectarian divisions, to address the specificity of the particular political problem of the turn in the situation, while holding on to the thread of the goal of working class emancipation is really hard, and is in many ways the real test of revolutionary politics. I think that reinforces a lot of what's been said from the front about the idea that there's some sort of immediate and self-evident way of being a communist at any moment that will directly lead to the overturning of capital is completely fallacious. Real communist politics is much, much, much more difficult than that.
So,
Just, you know, in a sense, the question of whether you want to define it political or not, by organizing, grassroots organizing. My point was it becomes political when it in some ways challenges the state, which doesn't mean that therefore grassroots organizing on its own somehow is unimportant, because the challenging the state will not happen unless you've already had some level of organization. I was just questioning that things can operate at that level quite often. Rather, one can be almost just satisfied with that grassroots organizing when one forgets that one has to actually intervene on the larger scale, otherwise one remains there. So, I mean, you know, that may be just a question of how we want to define the terms. My problem in a way is, although I, you know, use the technical and political composition of Russell, I'm very, you know, I'm happy with that discussion in many ways. I mean, I've written a critique of my own paper a couple of days ago, basically.
It's just a self-coup.
yeah. Well, which was simply, you know, the fact that the whole idea of factory schooling in Lenin is, you know, to do with the coordination and the discipline, etc., that comes from the factory, is to do with that capital was still conceived of as a moment of advance. You know, it was still a kind of progressive, or it was doing stuff that in some ways was furthering a possible struggle. Now, it seems to me that at a time when I would simply say now that role of capital is well and truly buried, it has no longer any role as advancing in any way or unifying. In fact, now it's pretty much fracturing on a large scale across the board, in, you know, workers from one another, etc. Then I did wonder, is there any schooling at that level anymore? And if that's the case, you know, how does the technical and political composition fit together? I mean, at that point, then there's the kind of Trontian autonomy of political move, where in actual fact, the moment of advance is the political composition, which feeds back and actually defines the technical. So, the question, but how one would think that? You know, I don't know. So I'm sort of questioning my own position there a bit, but I reckon, you know, that how those two articulate, maybe they don't always articulate, maybe there was a moment at which, you know, the technical moment was the moment of formation of the group, of the class, and from then that was appropriated, but maybe it doesn't always have to be that way, maybe now it has to be reversed, maybe it's the political composition of organizing the technical, and at that point, is how does one think that?
I wanted to answer Paul's point as well. I mean, there's a number of terms in your question that I think are very significant, but I'm not. I fear might remain in a way actually at a fairly abstract level. So, for instance, if you take the question of democratic control, I think one of the very intriguing issues at the present moment, even if you look at something as, you know, as in a sense, you know, minor in its capacities for concrete transformation of labor relations as struggles in the university, which I'm very well aware of you're part of, there is a very obvious way in which, you know, they bring up a problem I thought, you know, in the 70s Ernest Mandel put well, which is like, well, the difference between, you know, between workers' control and workers' management. I mean, you might be able to get quite far in more or less, you know, being able to have, you know, to have vaguely democratic decision-making powers in a situation in which you're essentially managing your own obsolescence, or managing your, you know, or managing resources that you don't have any control over. You're managing scarcity that's imposed upon you. That's very difficult, because I do think the question of control is very significant, but it's difficult to pose. I do think, though, maybe this echoes some of Peter's points. I'd be very careful in being too quick to think that, you know, to identify the problem of the party with the problem of unity as if what was absent from the movements that exist is their unity. Because I think there's a danger that all of the, you know, in terms of the political accumulation point that Peter was talking about, the experiences, tactics, etc., capabilities that have been built up over quite concrete and often, unfortunately, fragmented and disconnected struggles, are not multiplied by or reduced by certain, you know, by certain possible forms of unification. So, whilst it's it's clear that strategy and unity are not distinguishable points, my concern would be with the ways in which organizational forms have a potentiating effect. And I think the danger is to think that, well, you have this thing called the party, which then grafts onto forms of organization that we already know exist, like unions as they exist, associations, et cetera, and then that all we have to be able to do is to find the unity between these various movements as they exist. But I think the organizational question, in a sense, has to go, I mean, I'm sure you experience the organizational limitations of, teachers' unions in England as well. So the organizational question has to go all the way, you know, in a sense, all the way down. That's what I appreciated in Peter's question. This is not as some kind of like, you know, everything must be transformed, et cetera. But I think we do have to treat the questions about more explicitly political organization and, you know, labor organization, et cetera, together. And I wouldn't want to think of much as I have no allergy to the party form, intriguingly, the Invisible Committee of the Coming Insurrection had called for the building of one giant global party at the end of their talk at an anarchism conference. So maybe this will please you, I'm sure. I was a little taken aback. But I think the danger is that we think of the party as this thing that we drop into, this solution of kind of various movements, and all of a sudden, you know, this kind of unifies like the enemy of the Hobbesian Leviathan, but in a similar representation. And I would find that to be a bit of a problem.
If I could just come back on a point Matteo had raised, and the dialogue between Matteo and Paul. I mean, I agree with Paul. It's very important to conceive of all these instances of political organizing, that they are political. And I also agree with Matteo along the line of, you know, insisting that there is a certain political threshold, so to speak, in coming to confrontation with the state, we can define a properly political terrain. But I think, rather than saying politics is everywhere, you can, in some senses, say certain forms of politics are everywhere. So it's not a question that everything is political, but various organizing functions in the society, whether they're acknowledged as such or not, are already subordinate to certain political programs and are built in to that hegemonic project of a particular class. And often this is the bourgeois class. So there is the dimension that everything is already politicized, and in bourgeois society, in the various forms Gramsci refers to as passive revolution, that form of politicization is precisely depoliticization. It's precisely the form of politicizing that turns something into a technocratic administrative task, which is a bourgeois form of politics. Now the question there is how then to find an alternative transition to that, to undertake the type of move Paul's talking about, of taking up those organizing, those people engaged concretely in organizing different areas, and as it were stop them from being turned into technocrats, to engage them in a process of a coordination of people who are looking for a revolutionary politics beyond the normal standards of bourgeois technocratic administration. But this brings also to the questions you raised about technical and political class composition, which I think is really decisive and needs to be fleshed out properly. I disagree that we can go through different historical phases in which you go from technical class composition to political class composition, and a certain historical watershed comes, which conveniently sort of coincides with the oil crisis in the 70s, and then it goes from political composition back down to technical composition. Because I think historically what happens is you've got a constant dialectic between technical class composition and political class composition. Necessarily, that's always been going on. For certain instances, viewed from certain perspectives, it seems one is dominant and the other is subject to its demands, but I think concretely in struggles there's been a constant oscillation between them. It might be to think this properly and to avoid what I think is the fairly historiosophical conclusions that Tronti and Cacciari in particular come to, and for different reasons Negri takes another line. I think we probably need to expand those terms or link them up, not simply as technical class composition, political class composition, but to think about forms of political organization, forms of social association, the way in which they're continually interacting, because you never get one without the other. There's no moment of technical class composition that isn't already political class composition in some form, and vice versa. You have a superstructure in certain senses, but that's precisely in order to comprehend the structure. You have a structure, but that's not sufficient on its own. It always needs the forms of which it's comprehended. So we need to complexify those traditional terms through the from the workers' tradition today.
Yeah. Last year, students rioted, smashed up the Tory headquarters in London. Fantastic. As the branch secretary of my union, I then had to, under revolutionary discipline from my party, win the argument by supporting the students. You know, somebody sends me an email, RCG, you know, put the argument forward that we support the students. We win the argument inside the union branch that against strong opposition, against these anarchist wreckers and smasher-uppers and whatever else. We win the argument in the branch that we support them. Now, the interesting next step is, on the basis of winning that argument, I then get two anarchists who work at my place who email me they want to be union reps. So what we're talking about then in terms of building an organisation is not dropping down, it is then learning to kind of work with these people together in that movement. Through that question of experience and learning to do that with each other over the last. And very much my debates on anarchism, the article that I did in International Socialism and the reply that I'm going to write the next issue, is very much influenced not so much by what some guy in South Africa, South African anarchist has said, but much more in terms of the debates that I'm having with the anarchists around me, who are some of the reps alongside the communists and whatever else. In my institution. So it certainly isn't dropping it down, it's about how we weld it together.
No, I'm entirely in agreement with you on that, but to put it provocatively, I think the fact that you're a member of a revolutionary party is a condition rather than a necessary relationship to your form of organization. In the sense that I think that's a problem that anyone, you know, that's a problem. And I mean, from personal experience, I do think that the critical presence of a number of activists who are organized in, you know, your organization and others and so on and so forth has been quite critical. But I also do think that, to me, at that level, that's more of a that for me is more of a problem of what capacities have people developed within certain particular organizations. And I think that's definitely important. What kind of political education does one get or not get from being in one organization as opposed to another? I don't think that, to me, poses the problem of the party in the simple sense that I don't think there is actually any, so to speak, necessary link at that level, partly because of the nature of the struggle between somebody being or not being a Leninist in terms of how they organize at the level of the union branch. Though there might be more in terms of them being or not being an anarchist, of them, you know, in the sense of having resistances that wouldn't be otherwise present. So, you know, I still don't, you know, I don't, partly because it's a, you know, it's a very, so to speak, immature situation. I think those questions are questions of the level of political education now. They're not questions, to me, at this point of, you know, what is the relationship between the union and the party, I mean, in that sense. But my problem, just to finish with that, my problem is not the point, I don't want to, you know, parrot this kind of traditional, you know, party comes on from on high, whatever, because that's not the issue. My problem is how do we emphasize this question of unity, and I suppose my other question, which is, I think, significant for the union you know, for you know, class struggle and labor politics more in general, is the party or is a particular form of party the principal, you know, the principal motor or the principal instigator of the unification between struggles or not? And I'm not entirely certain that in all situations it is. I guess
I have something to say on that, but other people probably have.
Yeah, what's that? We have publishing houses and have a huge conferences like this, and we have parties a lot, and all the kinds of struggle and resistance are fully socially presented within the spectacular scene of let's say liberal bourgeois democracy. But the one thing which is really lacks is the underground war, because Bolsheviks, they were quite a tough guys, so they really went to prison. They were working like they did this dirty underground work. There was a conspiracy, and I don't see it now.
It's dirty and it's underground.
everybody wants to be like a public intellectual. Or, I remember once I was some group of leftist militants, and they decided like to be like a little bit more terrorist and to fire a building, and we were like wandering over around Moscow and trying to find the petrol, because you cannot buy petrol without a car. If you don't have a car, and it turns out that nobody is having a car in this small, I don't know, Trotsky's group.
Between the mass and those who have a certain developed consciousness, and then to work in that direction to form a sort of a movement in motion to have that dialectical part of the class. But there must be some moments of solitude, I think. Althusser talks about Machiavelli founding power and solitude and things like that. So are there moments where you have to get the ball rolling to sort of sequester yourself from what's going on empirically and sort of shut yourself up in Zurich and read Latin or do things like that? So are there moments of solitude that we have to consider before you can just engage in that dialectic of back and forth between parts of the class?
Anybody else want to comment?
Yeah,
just
a small remark also. What else can we propose? I think in the idea of democracy, there is such a tendency that people teach themselves, not teach themselves, but lose the desire to control the situation. Some infantile tendency. And for example, the idea of changing the world without taking power. Nobody wants to take power, actually, because power means responsibility and the violence and the control. No self-blood and dictatorship. Who wants the dictatorship? So this is also in the problem of organization is somehow connected with this confronting the absence of desire for dictatorship or something like this.
I'm just coming on what Harrison said. I mean, the question is also not simply as one between the party and the class, but also between differential levels inside the party. So Lenin, you know, is sitting in Zurich and reading a bit of Hegel, but the entire Bolshevik party, of course, you know, didn't manage to fit into that little room and read Hegel with him. You know, there are other people in the organization who are elsewhere doing other things at the same time. So that moment of solitude is also something that's determined inside relations inside a party. For example, the idea of a solitude of the party as such from the class has a very specific name. It's called the cult. It's complete separation of...
Well,
and we can look at historical instances. But you've got the continual relation, yeah, of relative absences, if you want, but they're never absolute. They're always mediated in different areas. And you have a disintegration of the class. You have a massacring of the class at different levels. But then you also have key areas of activity that are maintaining key contacts. At the same time, also remembering in that process that there's a massive wave of politicization that's been going on. So you've got people, you know, who are then participating in the activities of the Red Army. You've got millions of people who learn to read and write. And the Red Army spends more of its time teaching people how to read and write than it actually does fighting. We're talking, this is one of the great educational apparatuses of the 20th century. You've got all of these people being politicized and re-entering into these processes. Now, all of that's historically very complicated, but that dialectic between party and class and between elements inside the party, I think, is always tempered by the fact that the positions and poles are never absolute. They're always subject to various forms of compromise that hold them in some relation. But this brings me also to the point Alberto raised. He's expressed doubt about whether the party form was, in a sense, adequate for organizing today. And one maybe facetious response to that would be to say that we question and have doubts around the adequacy of the party form for political organizing, but the bourgeoisie does not. In this country, it's got two parties who organize these things called elections, and they do their stuff. But that's not simply some sort of pure veneer of bourgeois democracy. It's a powerful mechanism of organization, organized through parties of different types and in different ways, at which politics occur. The party, whether you call it the party or you call it something else, is always constituted actively in struggles. There will always be instances of organization and organizing instances. That's not the question, whether that exists or not. The question is how effective those organizing instances are going to be and what type of politics they're going to promote. So the real question is not whether the party remains its validity today. You know, we can use the word party or whatever other word we need to use. The real question is what type of party would be adequate for those organizing instances.
Yeah, just on the question of the moments of solitude, my late political mentor, Cy Landy, the worst thing he ever wrote was an essay entitled On Revolutionary Isolation. And shortly after he wrote it, some of the big struggles that Peter referred to earlier in the movement of movements started breaking out, and he recognized that the mistake. If one is a revolutionary, one is never isolated. If one is isolated, one is not acting as a revolutionary. It's almost definitional, a flux of determination. But on what Peter keeps bringing up about the different levels within the class, it's an important question, but the level at which someone is within the class is not something that is given and predetermined, but something that can change very rapidly as a result of political events. And I think this relates back to what Oksana was talking about you know, the need for a combination of different types of tactics. In Egypt, there was clearly illegal clandestine organizing going on before the recent outbreak, and afterwards we know about what some of that was. But ultimately, the reason why, when things reached the point where the government could no longer do anything about it, was precisely when everybody knew what was happening. And it's that moment when everybody knows, that everybody who is part of that, you know, that working class political subject knows what the tasks are on. Those are those moments of revolution. So.
I want to say something really briefly just about what Harrison was saying, and I think the point about the generals, so to speak, you know, aside from being a historically significant one, I think is a useful thing to think about, because one of the things that I was trying to get at in a way with this discussion of communization and so on is in a sense, well, what do you do about functioning in an emancipatory or transformative way through, you know, a world that's structured not just by the structure, you know, structures and hierarchies and asymmetries of capital, but also of those of the state. And I wouldn't want to, you know, I think you know, Marxists make too much of this kind of the model of revolutionary expediency, and there's people who even consider, you know, situations that are entirely different, you know, still might fantasize that, you know, they need to engage in certain forms of party organization because, you know, we're under threat or whatever. But I do think it's a very significant concern. And what really I think is striking, for instance, if one reads something like Moshe Levin's book on Lenin and the NEP, or indeed if one reads, you know, if one sees Lenin's own comments about the Goethe program and so on, is this whole question of, well, what, you know, that's in a sense kind of what I meant about the question of transition. What does it mean to have both a fairly stark realism about all that stuff that's not abolished, even were you to attain a considerable and, you know, at the present moment difficult to imagine level of power, but how do you go about, you know, disarticulating it? And that, you know, then that's the whole question of the kind of the non-state state question. You know, like what is the kind of organization that's capable, capable of not ossifying, but also capable of realizing all of the things that within itself and in the world in which it exists are structured by the very things that it's fighting against. And I think that, you know, I think, you know, that's for me in a sense, I mean, I definitely agree with Peter, you know, that whatever name we give to it, you know, organization on that level remains significant. But for me, a crucial question is, it's a kind of question of what are the internal controls and external controls that don't allow parties to fall to, you know, the, you know, a kind of like, you know, sort of iron law of oligarchy critique, you know, you're just going to recreate the very same structures of fighting against, etc., which I think is a, I think, you know, is a important question, but negating the party or the organization does not resolve it. You're just simply rendering yourself entirely powerless instead of trying to invent the means of not simply succumbing to the very problems that you're raising.
Yeah,